tonight on Arena. Bullet Train, 13 Lives and Maisie are the movies up for review. And Paula Meehan on how the Heydays episode of Ulysses and our need for rituals to deal with grief. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start this evening with our film reviews. Bullet Train finds Brad Pitt among a bunch of assassins on a Japanese speeding train from Tokyo to Kyoto. The film is directed by David Leitch. 13 Lives sees Ron Howard revisit the number 13. And like Apollo 13, 13 Lives deals with the real life and death rescue. This time, it's the story that grabbed world attention in the summer of 2018 when a young Thai football team and their coach were trapped in a flooded cave. Colin Farrell and Viggo Mortensen play the heroic British divers who masterminded the rescue. And Maisie is a documentary tribute to David Raven, a drag queen or drag artiste, as he would prefer to be called, who continues to perform well into his 80s. Ruth Barton, Paul Whittington have been watching all three and they join me now. And we'll start with Bullet Train. Brad Pitt here playing a hitman codenamed Ladybug gets on a fast train only to find that he is in the company of several other assassins who, like himself, all have nefarious purpose on board this train. Paul, a bullet train with several assassins on board, I suppose to paraphrase Bette Davis or Margot Channing, we are in for a bumpy ride here.
We are, and in fact we were worrying outside about which one of us was going to have to explain the plot because it's needlessly complicated. But to keep it as simple as we can, Brad Pitt is, Ladybug is his code name, and it's a reference to how unlucky he is, always bumping into things and so forth. He's on a train, he's been told by his handler, which is the voice of Sandra Bullock, that there's a suitcase on board. He has to get it. The suitcase is being minded by two goons from London, or allegedly from London, Tangerine and Lemon, played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Brian Tyree Henry. They're after the suitcase. A young, very innocent-looking, doe-eyed a girl called Prince, played by Joey King, is looking for it as well. There are several other parties looking for it, and behind it all is this terrifying villain called White Death.
I tell you.
Well done. That's well done, because I was actually going to have
you're
a
going lie down now.
I was going to have a bad moment and lie under the table if I was asked to do it.
Five stars for your description of the plot. Basically, they're all after the same thing.
And, yeah, it's Murder on the Orient Express, but it's a murder
Kung
on
Fu.
Kung Fu Murder on the Orient Express, but it's Bullet Train. And the really clever thing about this film, is that it takes 126 minutes to get from Tokyo to Kyoto, and that is the running time of this film.
And did they really mean that?
Sadly, that is the only clever thing about
the big takeaway from the scene.
Well, what about Sandra Bullock in Brad Pitt's ear? That surely has some value in it.
I wish she'd materialised out of his ear and onto the screen just a little bit earlier, because, I mean, here's this film. It is just full of references. Okay, so very clever, that speed, but that was a bus, this is a train, that was an accident, this is, you know, set in motion by this kind of Tarantino-esque confusion of plots. Had we seen a bit more of her, I would have been perhaps a bit happier. I thought actually Brad Pitt, I kind of liked him. I thought he was pretty good.
All right. There's a lot of action in it, which is always a challenge when it comes to finding clips. But here's a clip with Ladybug, played by Brad Pitt, being guided by the voice of Maria Beetle, that is Sandra Bullock, in his ear, literally. He sits down opposite Lemon, who is one of the other assassins on board, played by Brian Tyree Henry. And this is what happens.
I missed my stop.
Something else going on here.
Hi. You don't remember me.
You look like every white homeless man I've ever seen.
Really? You don't remember me?
If there was a gun under this table, I'd be as dead as that kid over there.
Huh?
And the little shh at the end then is Sandra Bullock telling him to be quiet while all of that action is happening.
Because it's a quiet carriage in the train.
That's
really funny too.
Okay. So it's a quiet carriage. You're not supposed to be making any noise. And it's an old lady actually who's telling him to please be quiet. We're on a long journey here. Well, 126-minute journey. And that gives me a sense of several things, not least of which is the kind of the Japanese style music going on in the background. And Elaine Shea-Chu was on with us last night talking about actors playing Asian roles, and this is an Asian role that Brad Pitt is playing.
Yeah, and in the original novel, which I mean I have to say I haven't read, they are Japanese characters on the train, and so what the film has done is westernized most of them, but it hasn't westernized all of them. So there's this kind of slightly sort of orientalist vibe to the whole film. Now, it's so intellectually vacuous, it doesn't particularly matter. It's not like anybody's passing, you know, the cultural appropriation ruler over it. But it is sort of it's got this kind of notional Japanese-ness to it, and a bit of a kind of Blade Runner feel, you know, that comes with that sort of we're in the Orient, as they used to like to say, so it's dangerous and it's fast. And then there are all these rather kind of, you know, allegedly rather sort of stupid Asian type tropes running through it, like the cartoon character that walks through the train.
And keeps getting punched.
But there's nothing authentically Asian about it, but then there's nothing authentically anything about this film. So I personally didn't lose sleep over that.
Yeah, okay, but we're in the world of an action movie, and if sometimes action movies are hard to explain because they have very complicated plots, but it's all about the action. Does that save us, Paul?
Well, no, not really. I mean, there are some good... David Leitch did the John Wick films, or the first one, rather, is involved in the first one, and he's a stunt coordinator, and some of the fight scenes are good. The emphasis is on humour and comedy, and Brad Pitt always seems to use unlikely objects to defend himself, and he insists on trying to reason with people who are trying to kill him all the time. So, but the problem for me, one of the problems, apart from the Orientalism thing, which is a very good point, which Ruth raised, the problem for me with it is this juxtaposition of humour and sadism I have always had a problem with, and it doesn't need to be as violent as it is at all. And it kind of misses a trick there. And had it had more of... giving a slightly more sense of Japan than the odd person bowing and a bullet train, that might have helped as well.
Let's have a listen to another clip here, which this features another of the assassins. Lemon was the first one.
Tangerine here.
This is Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and Ladybug, played by Brad Pitt, meets the Tangerine character. But then what comes along down the way, just as in the middle of a big scrap? The trolley, of course, comes along with the coffee on it.
I know who killed the kid.
I couldn't give a rat's ass.
I would love a bottle of water. That's the one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure you want to talk this out?
Not particularly, no.
Okay.
I know who killed the kid.
Yeah, where is he then?
He's on this train.
Well, that narrows it down then, doesn't it?
There we go. Aaron Taylor-Johnson as Tangerine, Brad Pitt as Ladybug in a scene there from Bullet Train. Is that kind of the funniest section, Paul was saying as we were listening to it there?
Yeah, that was because of this kind of, you know, gag that they stop for the trolley and then they kind of, you know, resume hostilities because it's choreographed like a kind of tennis match. Mm. So there are kind of some funny moments in it. And I went to see it in, you know, packed cinema, and people were laughing. I mean, you know, we're being pretty critical.
They had stuff to drink, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and a pizza. But we've been really critical about this film. I think some people will enjoy it.
Yeah. What about are there parallels here with we were talking about The Grey Man a couple of weeks back with the Russo brothers, and also the work of Tarantino.
Yeah.
Martin McDonagh seems to be in there as well. Guy Ritchie. Mm. All of those, are they referenced in a kind of a knowing way? Or
Guy Ritchie certainly is. I think Tarantino probably always is by these people. I have no reason why. I have no idea why. But the specific reference to Guy Ritchie here is in this freeze frame, and you get the name of the character, and you also get this potted backstory, which is a sure sign they're worried you won't be able to follow it. If you, I hate it, actually. It's very artificial and it breaks the film up. But Brad Pitt is good. He still has this kind of, he brings a sort of slacker charm to this, and he's very amusing in it, and very easy to watch as well. Still very charismatic. And Aaron Taylor Johnson is very good. He's very for this very excitable kind of West Ham supporting gangster.
Yeah. Oh yeah, there's a West Ham joke in it.
There
somebody
is even a West Ham
me.
Joke. Yeah, yeah. Especially right. for my brother. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so West Ham fans, this is the one for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So apart from West Ham fans, those of us who might not be West Ham fans, how many
slim
stars?
Pickings for us Chelsea fans. I'd give it two and a bit maybe, but yeah. it doesn't really know what it's doing, and you kind of lose interest in it halfway through.
Okay, two, and I will disassociate myself from the us Chelsea fans there. And Ruth,
I gave it three because I thought two for the movie, but one for Brad Pitt, who I thought, you know, he didn't need to try hard with this movie because he's fair. Made his millions. He could have just turned up, but he gave it something.
Yeah, kind of unusual to see him
doing something different as well.
I thought kind of fair enough.
All
for
right.
him, so.
Okay. Okay, that's bullet train. Let's move on then to 13 Lives. Never afraid of the big canvas in 13 Lives. Apollo 13 director Ron Howard takes on the story of the rescue of the young boys football team who were trapped in an underground flooded cave in Thailand in the summer of 2018. This is a story, I mean, there have been documentaries, there have been books, but Howard has taken a fictional approach here, casting Colin Farrell, Viggo Mortensen as the British divers who take on the job of finding the boys as the flood waters rise. Just first of all, Ruth, maybe recall that summer of 2018. I mean, we were all glued to our televisions watching this.
We were all gripped because it went on for so long. We went on for over 2 weeks, and you were finding information in real time as they recreate in the movie, because everybody assumed in the beginning these boys couldn't survive. Mm. And then there was this race against time in real life, which was the monsoon coming and the fact that the cave would be flooded even more than it already was. And then there's the constant reporting going on, and then sort of cuts in, you know, on the news to the anxious families. And then this extraordinary, I mean, you know, you don't need to fictionalize any of this because the story was so extraordinary. I'd kind of forgotten the incredible twist where they decide the only way they can rescue the kids. First of all, these are amateurs, the divers, and they decide the only way they can rescue the kids is to anaesthetize them, and to make them basically, as they call them, into packages, because the children could not possibly.
Yeah,
you know,
manage the diving. That there was one really narrow passage.
Yeah, but they had to be underwater, and so the kids would have panicked. They couldn't have done it. So they managed to persuade one of the other divers, who discovers that he's been invited along because he's an anaesthetist, to anaesthetize these kids.
Worthington, isn't it?
Yeah, just extraordinary.
And at one level, I mean, obviously this is a great rescue story, etc. But the trap is, in come the British divers, in come the foreigners, and
I actually think he was quite careful about that, because there was a documentary, one particular documentary made about that, and I thought it was quite cheap in the way it used music to kind of pull your heartstrings. You don't need your heartstring pulled if a group of boys are trapped in a cave. And I thought this handled that quite well, because there's this poor governor who's about to be sacked, who's the one who's going to face the blame if it all goes wrong. And it makes the point that all these villagers came together to stop the water that was coming off the mountain flooding into the cave and making things worse after this unseasonal rain. The Thai SEALs were incredibly brave because they had less experience than those two British fellas. And one of them died. And I think it makes it very clear it's a collaborative effort. But obviously, if you use Colin Farrell and Viggo Mortensen, your focus as a Western person is going to be on them to some extent. They are quite the double act, quite funny together.
Right, well, let's have a clip which features the two of them. John Valentin was the Colin Farrell character, and he discovers the boys deep within the tunnel, and we hear from some of the boys in the cave as well. And then the joy it must have been to have seen somebody coming towards them.
Found the boys. They're alive. You are very brave. How do you stay so strong?
We are a team. We help each other. And our coach help us.
Coach.
ผมต้องขอโทษด้วยนะครับที่พาเด็กมาเสี่ยงอันตราย
ไม่จริงครับ
ไม่ได้ครับ
คุณด้วยมุมครับ
ไม่ใช่ครับโค้ช
คนเก่งที่สุดครับ
It's because of our coach. We are stay strong. He teach us to meditate.
โคตรบอกให้เขาสวดมนต์ครับ
And we pray.
You pray?
Yes.
I bet you do. All right.
Colin Farrell there as John Valentin and some of the young boys who were trapped in the cave, the various actors that are playing them, and different languages obviously being used within that as well. Ruth, I was saying, even as we were listening to that clip, I remembered the moment that they found the boys, and you can still see them in my mind's eye. I can see them, you know, some of them sitting a little bit higher up on a perched on a rock, some of them standing up, and this extraordinary moment, all 13 of them, they're here, the football team and the coach, all alive.
Extraordinary. Just unbelievable. I mean, it's a really moving scene. Mm. And I thought they underplayed it very nicely at that moment. They didn't do the big Hollywood drum roll. And that's one of the things. I thought Colin Farrell was great in this, and Viggo Mortensen. And they're underplaying because they're only amateurs. So they're not the big stars. I totally agree with Paul. This isn't a white rescue story. And one of the things that these two stars do is they underplay themselves so much that you believe they're ordinary blokes. Mm. And so they don't make a big melodrama out of the moment that they find the kids. Because I think, you know, when you're watching it, they're so taken aback at finding them because they didn't expect to. That the kind of realization is dramatic enough without having to add kind of Hollywood oomph to it.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. And there's the point as well that the two of them realize, everybody's celebrating, and they're going, why are you celebrating? How the hell are we going to get
there? And again, it's the same thing with Apollo 13. Ron Howard had this challenge. Mm. We all know Apollo 13 came back and everything was back. Yeah. We all know that 13 of them got out and that everything
How do you
create drama then?
Incredibly, he does. I mean, I was going to say he's never made a bad film, but he made The Da Vinci Code, didn't he? But
he made Far and Away.
True. I forgot that. That was a very bad
film. It's not even a film. Yeah, anyway. Film.
But he's a really, really good storytelling film. A bit like Steven Spielberg is, actually, without the flourishes. He's really good at telling a story. And I think there's a brilliant sequence in it where the two of them just turn up. And we say they're amateurs, but they've been doing it for years. They turn up, they walk past the engineers, put the flippers on, dive in, and for 3 hours swim through the... So it's really well told, the story. And there's great... drama. You sort of forget that you know, and there's great drama in the scenes, and I didn't understand half of how they did what they had done because they kept some of it quiet. I think he does it really well.
Yeah, and I remember speaking to him. It's funny you talk about that underplaying aspect. I was talking to the Irish diver who was involved in the rescue as well, and was involved in the documentary that was made about it, and he was underplaying everything. It's like that's what we do. We go into caves and we rescue people. It was all matter of fact. What else would you do other than rescue them?
There's a running gag about custard creams, and they're more occupied by the custard cream at the time than, you know, because they can't worry about themselves either.
So, and given the fact that we've had already had a documentary, I think there's another one on the way as well. What does dramatisation bring? What does that bring to the telling of the story that perhaps wouldn't be there, Ruth?
Yeah, I think it's that kind of sense of immersiveness, literally in this case, because what he does is he plays over and over again the going into the cave, the going out of the cave, the going, and you know, sometimes that seems a bit long, but at the same time it literally pulls you into, and you can see in the length of those sequences the emotional physical drain that it is on the men taking part, because it goes on and on. You see the bubbles coming up, you see the murkiness. It's actually beautifully shot, the film too. And so I think there's a real value to restaging it as a drama.
Yeah.
And also it brings in a bit of warmth that the documentary can't quite do.
Yeah,
you get nuance in a drama if it's done right. You don't get in a documentary, and it's very careful not to sneer at what other people might call superstitions and religious aspects, because people were praying in different ways and reacting in different ways.
If your kid was in there, you might be able to grab onto any superstition you could get.
Sure, yeah.
All right, stars from you, Paul.
Four, yeah.
Four from you. And what are you saying overall, Ruth?
Yeah, four from me as well.
Four, so very solid double four there for 13 Lives. Let's move on to our third film, Maisie, documentary about David Raven, also known as Maisie Trollette, who well into his 80s is the UK's oldest performing drag artiste. This is directed by Lee Cooper. David Raven, who is he? I mean, he's such a gorgeous guy, really, that we meet. And we meet him as he wants us to... He's David Raven when he's not in his gear, and he's Maisie when he is in his gear.
Yeah, the character is is distinct. And as we were saying earlier, he's very, very old school. There's kind of bits of Danny LaRue in there and other things, if people remember Danny LaRue. And he's not somebody who would ever be comfortable walking down the street in drag. He does his drag at the clubs. He's been doing it for years and years and years, and he's still going strong. There's a little reference to the fact that he may have a dementia, but he's still performing, and he tells these brilliant stories about what it was like. And in ways, you know, we're always saying at the moment how awful the world is, but some things have improved, and he lived through some tough days doing what he did and being gay.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip. And this is when we meet him very early on in the film, and he's going through his garden, and there's a little joke within this which gives you a sense of the nature of the humour that is there throughout the film, in fact.
This is my retreat. This is what keeps me going. And I'm quite proud of the garden, really, because when I bought this place all those years ago, there was nothing. It was, everything I've done is planted as me, and I adore it. And of course, that's all my own private walkway there. No one else can get in here, completely on my own, you see. Sometimes in the summer, I can lay it on here with just a little bikini, and I've got very good neighbours. Hardly ever see them. The rose bush, which attacked me last week, and I fell onto the rose bush, and I had very bad cuts on my legs. I've got a few pansies there, but as I'm working on the theatre scene, in the gay scene, I see enough pansies in Brighton, so I don't grow too many of them.
There you go.
So predictable.
So yeah, I know. There was a big signpost over the joke before it came. And you know, and at different times in the film, they actually do the little ba-doom-sh with the drum.
Do,
you know,
yeah. And he deserves it because he's such a trooper.
Charming.
Yeah.
So,
he is,
but
yeah.
You know, obviously, we get a sense of this man and his life as a performer. You know, pantomime dim, really, as much as anything else, is what we're talking about here. Do we get any sense of how he dealt with his gayness in the midst of all of this, and what being a gay man in Britain, I suppose, of the early part of the 20s, early to mid 20th century, what it was like?
Yeah, you do. I mean, I would have liked perhaps a little bit more of that. It's almost, you get this sort of flashback through the photographs. There is one sequence where he talks about his partner Don, who died, I think we have to imagine, of AIDS.
And he
they play back a radio interview he gave a while back, in which he's in tears. He can't talk about this, but it's also, you get the real sense of the secret nature of AIDS and the secret nature of gay life then. And even now, he won't say he's going to a gay bar. He just hides that fact. So I think what you get is somebody who is, I mean, he does have, you know, memory issues. You can hear his slightly reaching for words, even in that sequence that we heard. But he's somebody who, he's even though they were bad times, he's still sort of slightly living in them. You know, this isn't RuPaul.
No, there's no sign of RuPaul, at all, of the kind of the modern...
Absolutely, and there's a sequence where he's performing what looks like a pretty shabby kind of hotel. It's all sort of beiges and you know, formica top tables. And actually, at this moment, I thought, it's a bit like a retirement home for drag queens. Then I had this wonder of, like, what about a retirement home for drag queens? But that's his, you know, his aging audience and his aging body, this is about.
And it's the whole cabaret scene in Brighton, and those who have worked in the cabaret scene who are absolutely adore him. But there's also a guy who comes over from America, Walter XV, or Walter, whose drag name is Darcel XV. Interesting to know. He's the oldest in the entire world.
Yeah.
There's a bit of an edgy dynamic between them.
There is, and yet that was the least interesting part of the film for me. I didn't think it needed that. I think we needed him and this lovely circle of people who watch over him in Brighton and all those wonderful stories. Like, he tells this great story about how in Vauxhall, in some gay pub, which he wouldn't call it a gay pub in the 60s, and the police, or it was the 80s, I think, the police raided, and one of them said to the owner, "Get your mother upstairs, she doesn't need to see this." And he was referring to him, and he was shocked by this. So I think it's all about him and his stories. You don't need to veer away from that, really.
Yeah, and he's just a gentle guy. And
he's very charming. Yeah. And as Paul was saying, he's got this lovely circle of friends who are looking after
the
him.
Support. Yeah, the support. And it's very emotional. He sings this big song at the end, "If I Never Sing Again." And there's something is just beautiful about the way it's high in emotion.
And when he performs, all the dementia falls away. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He's his old self again.
Stars from you on this one, Ruth?
I give it 3.5.
3.5. What are you saying, Paul?
And actually, I would concur, 3.5. I really enjoyed it.
Fairly solid stuff indeed. That's Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington. Bullet Train is in cinemas nationwide. 13 Lives is in selected cinemas, and it's available on Amazon Prime from tomorrow. And Maisie is also at selected films. Well, the 4th of August is today's date, and it marks the 60th anniversary of the death of perhaps one of the most famous film stars of them all. Here is Marilyn.
I want to be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I want to be loved by you alone. Boop-boop-be-doo. I want to be kissed by you, just you, nobody else but you. I want to be kissed by you alone. I couldn't aspire to anything higher than to feel the desire to make you my own. Ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-doo-dee-dum. I wanna be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you alone.
I want to be loved by you, remembering her. She died 60 years ago today. Kilkenny Arts Festival begins today. Among the strong lineup of artists on this year's programme is poet Paula Meehan and Ilan Piper David Parb. They team up next weekend, the 13th and 14th of August, at the Parade Tower for an hour of words and music. For the Hungry Ghosts is the name of the event and the name of Paula Meehan's new poetry collection. These are poems of mourning and survival written in response to the Heydays episode of Joyce's Ulysses. And this is all part of the larger Ulysses 2.2 project, in which 18 sets of artists make new work inspired by the 18 episodes of the great book itself in its centenary year. And Paula Meehan with me in studio this evening. I suppose, first of all, Paul, just in terms of that Ulysses 2.2 project, ANU, Landmark and Productions and Molly, the Museum of Literature Ireland, all involved in choosing these 18 artists. At what point were you invited on board, and what about the episode that was presented to you as the one to which you would respond?
The Troika, as I call them, the three commissioning agents, and they were fantastic, you know. Well, it was quite early. It was last year, and I got a call from Matt Smith from A&O Productions, and was I interested? And immediately I said yes, because of the calibre of the Troika themselves, these organisations that I respect, and indeed many of the artists, like Louise Lowe, I think is just a genius, you know. So I said, yeah, I'll go for it. And then there was a kind of a lull, and then I was presented with the Heydays episode, you know, and I didn't want to think too much about why I, as a poet, was being associated with the underworld and journeys to the other side, to the other world, to the land of the dead.
Yeah, this is where Bloom heads across to Glasnevin. Yeah.
He's going to a funeral, essentially, Leopold, and he's in the carriage with the lads. And it's all very Dublin-esque, you know, there's little digs and bits of gossip. And he's, as they would say nowadays, othered as a Jewish man in Dublin. But what really gave me permission for the work I did in the poetry was that his interior life, as he's heading to the funeral, is about his own losses. The suicide of his father down in Ennis, the death of his child, Rudy, his uncertainties and anxieties around his wife and around his teenage daughter, Millie, who's taken up an apprenticeship with a photographer up in Mullingar. So he's wondering, will I go and visit her? But what if I walk in on her? You know, she's at that age. What does that mean? So there's these kind of tortured father, tortured husband and grieving son, grieving father. So these kind of gave me permissions to go the route I did, which was really into the land of my own debt.
And griefs in within your own life.
Yeah, within both griefs within my own life, but also inherited griefs from community, from family, unresolved stuff from history of just of being an Irish woman in these times. And I think probably the plague reinforced that we had these years where certain things were manifest, you know.
And where in fact we couldn't express our grief, where we couldn't deal with grief, the funeral, the thing that we all, maybe not love isn't the right word, which is the great ritual passage with often through grief is the funeral and that, the wake and the funeral and all of those events, which we just couldn't be had.
Yeah, exactly. And I do have a couple of elegies for poets that we lost. I mean, the poetry community was really grieved by the loss of Yvan Boland, Brendan Kennelly, Thomas Kinsella, just to ones that are well known, but there were many other losses. So I felt it gave me the space to do that work.
Yeah. Maybe we could hear one of the poems then, and this is At the Sign of the White Horse.
Okay.
Give us the context for the poem here and the context for how it fits into Bloom's journey over to Glasnevin.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know, because Joyce was responding to a much older text, the Odyssey, where Odysseus is on his rambles on his way home from Troy and he puts in at these islands. And I've spent my life going to Greece. You know, I've spent my life going island to island. I've lived on the Greek islands, different ones. So this really gave me permission to look at it's set on an island. But also in the Buddhist tradition, the hungry ghosts are addictions and things that won't give your mind rest. You know what William Blake calls mind-forged manacles. And on one level, it's all in the mind. So this was my chance to work a bit with, resolving carryover addiction stuff.
Yeah.
So this is At the Sign of the White Horse. We called it a day. We called it a night. There was absinthe, there was Cipro, there was amnesia, there was oblivion. The waves far out were wild and white-capped, but those close in lapped and lipped at the shore, like whispers, like kisses. A red-sailed schooner made in for safe haven. The barman's arms were tattooed with skulls and crosses like kisses. Round his neck were a rosary or a garrote. I remember thinking, if thinking it was. I was three sheets in the wind and listing to starboard, so I offer this witness with caveat and warning. The children played on the sand, their squabbles microcosmic to the storm that was brewing. Chair-toppling squalls blew my lines off my sheet, my sheets off the lines. So much to remember, so much to forget. The sun was setting, a new moon rising. It was sextile Neptune, if it matters to you. It matters to me, my first day sober. I died in your arms at the sign of the white horse, my old self tucked in a bed of soft clay, in that port of white towers, white houses, white streets. The leaves that dropped on my grave were blessings, the white rose you laid there a token of hope. The winter would shrive me, would scour me, would save me. When I rose from the dead, I was dressed in white linen, my angel of mercy, my angel of kindness, wreathed in myrtle, smelling of pine, on your milk-white steed, with your milk-white promises. I was lady of as much land as I could ride in a long summer's day.
That's the poem At the Sign of the White Horse from Paula Meehan, that part of her collection For the Hungry Ghosts, which itself is part of this Ulysses 2.2 project. And you were, I suppose, responding, Paula, within the poems in this collection to that sixth episode, the Head Is episode of Joyce's Ulysses. It's not the first time that you've responded to Joyce's Ulysses in poetry. I think that you have a little haiku. Do you remember that offhand?
I do, yeah. It was called First Love, or sometimes it was called Young Love, because there's variants on it. But it is essentially a haiku that goes, "That Skerry's winter, you read me Ulysses night after broken night." So I was really lucky that my first exposure, as it were, to the book wasn't through the text. It was through hearing it. And it was a boyfriend I had when I was young and feckless. And he was young and even more feckless. And we lived in a kind of cheap winter let out in Skerries. I was supposed to be a student, you know, but I only really went. Actually, the only things I ever got up and went into town for was a course by W.B. Stanford, the great classicist, on Greek myths and the great poets of Greece, you know, the playwrights, Euripides and Aeschylus and Sophocles. And I dragged myself into town for them. Otherwise, I just lived.
And this year, This guy was reading Ulysses to you, so he was doing the reading, you were doing the listening, which is a great way to get to hear that book.
And it meant I wasn't afraid of the book when I came to read it later. I wasn't afraid of it. I expected to have a pleasurable experience, which is not how a lot of people go to the book. They go with fear and anxiety that they'll.
But you also, I think, in the reading of this book, in the reading of the Hades episode, when you came to it this time around, it brought you to your own ancestors, to your, you know, Joyce's 1904 was the, who was born in 1904?
My grandmother was born in 1904, yeah. And of course, famously, Joyce's Night Town episode is the entrance there, you know, the entrance, it's now James Joyce Street.
Yeah.
It would have been Mabbott Street when my grandfather was born on that street. So my people would go right back into Monto, which at the time Joyce was writing about was the biggest red light district in Europe, in the whole of Europe. And I mean, it is a real moment as it comes into the revolutionary years. It's a real lens on what we were becoming, the post-colonial theocracy. So that segue from the biggest red light district as the troops pulled out, pun intended, the decline of the area as a kind of an economic viable place in those terms.
And in terms of the collection of poetry then, and, you know, For the Hungry Ghost. I presume that many of the poems that you have in there refer then specifically to your grandparents and great grandparents. Your grandmother has always been a big part of your work.
She absolutely, Hannah, and she would bring me down to visit her old friends down in, like, this would have been the late 50s, early 60s. So, I mean, the area was devastated and in decline. But still, you know, the stories I would have been hearing, which I wouldn't have really understood as a child. But you say everybody in Monto has blue blood in them, you know, when I'd be disparaging people and the state of the gaff. So, you know, they were clues that I didn't really put together till I was much older. And in fact, it was the Folklore Project down there, Terry Fagan and the Folklore Project, that opened the doors into the history. But the history, the written history, is totally unreliable because nobody was telling the truth to power. So even the senses, you have to decode them. In fact, there's more truth in the folklore.
Yeah,
but Joyce would have seen those people. He would have seen what I consider, you know, my ancestors.
Now, part of the event then in Kilkenny for The Hungry Ghosts is the presence of the piper, David Power. Let's have a listen to David, a little bit of his track called On Lan of Shee. A little flavour of On Lan of Shee from piper David Power, and David will be part of For the Hungry Ghosts, the event that Paula Meehan is telling me about this evening, which is part of the Kilkenny Arts Festival. And even just listening to the pipes there, Paula, that kind of plaintive cry that they have, it kind of fits in with this journey to the underworld aspect that you're talking about that really spoke to you within the Haydays episode.
Totally. And I mean, the Haydays episode, the symbol of it is, you know, every episode has an organ of the body or a piece of the body, was the heart. So I think there's nothing like the Uilleann pipes to open the heart, the resonance of them in your actual body, to open the heart to the world, you know. I think I've always found them especially powerful in grieving material.
Yeah, and I was going to say the fact that you have the elegies in the book as well. I don't know how many of the elegies will feature as part of the event.
There's a few of them, all right.
I presume you can't give us all the poems.
No, it's a selection. And I am so lucky to have a musician of the calibre of David Power to play along with it, you know. And the rehearsals have been amazing to see the range.
And is it a matter then of choosing poems and matching tunes that David might have, either traditional tunes or his own tunes that he's putting in there?
Yeah. Tunes from the tradition or tunes that Joyce actually features in the episode, because, as you know, it's saturated the whole book with music. But also his, where he can take it himself, you know, because he's not just, you know, a maestro in the tradition, but he pushes out the tradition onwards.
Yes, David Power himself really does. I suppose that's what Joyce was doing, if you think about it, in terms of novel writing. So suitable that you should be doing the same in terms of the music. We'll finish up then by listening to one of the poems, which I think kind of speaks directly to the pipes and the pipe, the presence of the pipes.
Because it was the poem, this poem, that made me think I should be doing this with a piper.
Yeah.
Okay. Of breath, no breath, and didgeridoos. All the length of Grafton Street I was played, the sound resonating in my belly. I felt it first, then heard it. It lured me through the crowds, the city noise, the sirens. It brought me to my knees on the pavement grey. It filled my every cavity. It thrilled me to the marrow of my bones. And when the young Aboriginal took a break, he told me he was busking around the world. He was musician, archaeologist by trade. His story went, once on a dig in his home place, they unearthed an ironwood tube so old and so long buried it had opalesced. His first breath in many a thousand year to travel the length and enter living ears. The way he said, my people, had me close to tears. I waxed, I waned, I wept, I effervesced. What was base and toxic turned to gold. The wonder that breath itself was instrument of grace. I understood the tune could heal if played at the body ailing or broken as it whirled, as it skirled, as it whirled to ease ague or ache or whatever else might ail skin or bone or vein. These patterned dreamtime cures passed down by skilled adepts, the right notes in the right ordered way, very like our own pipers, coaxing the tunes from a promise of air, rested, let free of the chanter, hand-wrought and fingered. Oh, tell me, teach me, show me, where should I offer my gratitude?
Of Breath, No Breath and Didgeridoo's poem there from Paula Meehan, and that no doubt will be part of Paula and David Power's presentation for The Hungry Ghost, which is at the Parade Tower in Kilkenny, 13th and 14th of August as part of this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. Further details on kilkennyarts.ie, and Paula's poetry collection for The Hungry Ghost is published by ETYM Press. Now, we often hear of seminal albums that changed the course of popular music history. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from the Beatles, Nirvana's Nevermind, The Dark Side of the Moon from Pink Floyd. In classical music history, before the album existed, it was works like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and indeed the work that we're going to speak about this evening, Johann Sebastian Bach's The Well-Tempered Clavier, collection of preludes and fugues composed by Bach in and around 1722. To this day, music historians regard this collection as a turning point in musical history, influencing every form of Western music that came afterwards. On Friday, August the 12th and Saturday the 13th, next week, world-renowned organist and harpsichord player Malcolm Proud will perform Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier at St. John's Prairie in Kilkenny as part of Kilkenny Arts Festival. And delighted that Malcolm is with me in studio this evening. I suppose to get a sense of what this, why this is such an important set of pieces, and there, I know there are two books, we'll come back to that in a minute, Malcolm. It's the word tempered, I think, that is the one we probably have to explain, isn't it?
Yep. Well-tempered means well-tuned. In the 16th century, the tunings that were used favoured the keys with the least number of sharps and flats. So when Bach and a few other composers around his time starting to write in keys with lots of sharps or flats in the key signatures, then they needed to be able to devise a system of tuning which made it possible to play in those strange keys.
And I suppose that this refers, if you think about traditional music and which would have existed before that, probably in fairly straightforward keys like C, D and G were probably what we were talking about generally. When it came to classical music, they wanted more variety of keys and to be able to go to minor keys and things like that, which involved sharps and flats that just were hard to find on a keyboard.
Yeah, nowadays, if you have a piano, you're probably familiar with the piano tuner coming along, and he tunes it, the piano, so that every key sounds the same. It doesn't matter whether it's C major or C sharp major. They sound identical, but in the 18th century, they wanted different keys to have slightly different colours. So they used a different system.
Yeah, and hence we got that idea of the black notes and the white notes in the case of the piano. It's the other way around in the case of the harpsichord.
Well, sometimes it's the other way around.
Yeah, for the most part, I think it generally is. So let's have a listen to one of the preludes and fugues. This, in fact, is the one in G major, and this is a recording that you have made yourself on harpsichord. And we listen to the prelude in full, I suppose, and then we listen to a little bit of the fugue just to get a sense of what happens. That's the prelude and part of the fugue in G major from Johann Sebastian Bach, in a recording made by Malcolm Proud. And Malcolm is with me in studio this evening ahead of his performance of the two books of preludes.
No, just one book.
Oh, you're just performing one of the books.
Book one, because it was issued in 1722, so it's the 300th anniversary.
Ah, right. So it makes sense. So you'll have to wait another 20 years before before you perform book two.
There's a specific date on the title page of book one, but we don't know precisely when book two appeared.
But I suppose what's interesting in terms of the instrument as well, you were playing on harpsichord there, but what was happening to keyboards in and around this time is very interesting, because a clavier kind of refers to the keyboard in general in terms of the well-tempered clavier.
Yes, although it seems that Bach had in mind the harpsichord in this particular instance.
But what was happening to keyboards at this time that was part of this well-tempered tuning side of musical history, but also what would develop in terms of the piano eventually?
Well, it's funny, we talk about the piano, but of course piano means soft, and it seems to imply that all pianos are very soft instruments, but originally they were called the forte piano because they could play loud and soft depending on how much force you use in your fingers, how much weight you used on the keys. But it didn't matter how much force or weight you used when you were playing the harpsichord or the organ, because the key would be the same loudness.
Yeah, it plucks the string, so it doesn't matter how hard you hit the key, it's the plucking action that creates the level, the dynamic, I suppose, that we're talking. And what is the joy then? What is the joy of the harpsichord for you, which is, I think, generally the instrument with which people will associate you?
Well, I think while the harpsichord is particularly well suited to playing this sort of polyphonic or contrapuntal music because of the clarity. The later, especially the grand piano, which we know today, it's more a harmonic instrument. It's difficult for the lower register to sound clearly in a fugal context when there's different voices.
Yeah, so and by voices we heard a little bit of it in the fugue that we heard there, where I suppose one hand is playing one tune. It's easy when there are only two voices. One hand starts singing the voice, if you like, the other hand starts playing the other voices. But there are times when there could be, you were telling me, up to five voices sounding.
Absolutely, yeah, and there are pieces by Bach which are six or even more voices.
That's quite a challenge with only two hands.
Yeah, the six voice, I think there's the Richard Carr in from the musical Offering, but also often we have to remember he also was an organist, so he had the benefit of foot pedals
as well.
So he could
yes,
play voices.
What do you think was so radical and so important about the Well-Tempered Clavier then, this set of pieces?
What's so important? Well, Bach wanted to compose lots of teaching materials. He was a very important teacher in his time, not only for his own sons, but also other musicians younger than himself. And he also was around about 1722, he was applying for the position in Leipzig, Cantor, the Thomas School. And he wanted to show the authorities there, his potential employers, exactly what he could do. And his predecessor was Johann Kuhnau, and he had composed partitas in 14 different keys. So Bach wanted to show he could go much further.
I can do
more. And people talk about the 24 keys, but in fact, Book One already uses 25 keys.
Because right, so he was ahead of the posse.
He had, yeah, the prelude in E-flat minor is coupled with a fugue in D-sharp minor.
Yeah, so he added in a 25th key not to be outdone, Mr. Johann Sebastian Bach.
Never been outdone.
Okay, well, listen, thanks for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us, Malcolm. Malcolm Proud there. You can hear Malcolm perform Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier Book 1 at St. John's Priory in Kilkenny on Friday, the August the 12th, and again on Saturday the 13th. Both concerts taking place at 1 p.m. and at 3 p.m. on Friday, August the 12th. Malcolm will talk a bit more about how significant a turning point these compositions were, and that's also at St. John's Priory. KilkennyArts.ie for all details on that and everything happening at the festival. And that is our lot for this Tuesday, Wednesday, Monday. For Thursday evening. Thursday. We're on Thursday. Yeah. We're getting there on this Thursday evening. Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Keishi. I'm going off to look at the calendar. And I'll be back with you tomorrow night, Friday night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.